so foolish as to think there is only one kind of sailor that comes from the Barbary coast of Africa. But there is a particular sort of ship that makes berth there, and most of them are in the business of piracy. And most are not the sort of cuddly pirates with career aspirations that we found in Scipio and his men. I remember the fear in the sailor's eyes when Sim showed him her arm, too intense to be raised by a scratch or a scar. "What's on your arm?" I ask before I can stop myself. I'm not certain if she can follow the complex footwork that led me to this conversational pivot, but I say, "I'm not stupid. You showed that man something, and suddenly he was willing to help us." She doesn't turn, just darts me another sideways glance. I almost miss it in the fall of her scarf.
"It's a mark."
"Like a mole?" I can hear her teeth grind.
"No, not like a mole."
"Is it a crown and a cleaver?" She lets out a tense sigh, lips pursed so hard her skin pinks.
"I didn't think you heard that."
"How did you know it would frighten him?"
"He's got ink on him. That means he's sailed where frightening things happen to honest sailors who cross that banner."
"Are you one of the honest sailors?" I ask.
"No,"
she replies, and sticks the marlin spike hard into her boot.
"Oh."
I turn forward. She straightens. We both stare out across the grey water, watching England disappear into the fog, and all I can think is that if she's not one of the honest sailors, it may mean she's one of the frightening things.
Stuttgart. 7.
Our journey from Calais to Stuttgart is done in crowded diligences that hop from city to city along rutted roads. Close quarters are our only barrier against the cold. I may wear holes in my cloak for all the scrubbing up and down arms I have done, and I fear for my already deteriorating posture, for with every passing mile I feel more and more concave, my shoulders pulling over my knees, my back in a half moon, with my cloak tented around me. We sleep mostly on the coaches, only two nights in roadside inns, where Sim and I are forced to separate because of our respective skin colours. And while I am opposed to inequality in all forms, it's the only time we have apart all the while we're on the road, and it's not unwelcome. Sim is a quiet companion. She does not seem to need the company of books or chatter to find diligence journeys bearable. She doesn't fill the silence with conversation unless I initiate it. She lets me talk to most of the ticket clerks and innkeepers and diligence drivers, both of us knowing that most would be even less forthcoming to an African woman than they are to a fair-skinned one, and I have to field my share of questions about who I'm travelling with and where's my chaperone and why it is I'm going anywhere with just a maid hardly older than me. I can see the hard line of her jaw tense every time I step up instead of her, but neither of us says anything about it. When we reach Stuttgart, a quaint Germanic town with half-timbered houses crowded around squares, all draped in a gentle cloak of new snow, I get the Hoffman's address from the records office, while Sim finds a dressmaker who can fix me something that will be appropriate for wedding festivities, but in a forgettable enough colour that no one will notice repeat wearings. We start out on foot for the address several miles outside of town. The countryside is heavily wooded, but the austerity of winter has rendered the trees no more than rickety silhouettes, their tops wrapped in thorny mistletoe. We pass a farmhouse with a thin drizzle of smoke rising from its chimney and a stork nested against its shingles. The thin layer of snow coating the earth has been trampled to mud and turned to ice so that the ground looks bruised and worn. It all seems a charcoal drawing of a landscape.
"How do you know her?"
Sim asks as we walk. Her breath is coming out in short white puffs against the air.
Miss Hoffman, she qualifies, when I don't answer right away. Because, so far, you've only spoken of the doctor she's marrying.
We grew up together, I reply, for it seems the simplest answer.
It does not satisfy, Sim.
Were you close?
Close seems too small a word for my single childhood friend. Joanna, an only child with an absent mother and father often abroad, and I with parents who I was sure sometimes forgot my name, found a whole world within each other. We tore up the forest between our houses, made up stories about being explorers in faraway corners of the world, foraging for medicinal plants and discovering new species that we would name after ourselves. She was famous naturalist Sybil Glass, and I, the equally famous Dr. Elizabeth Brilliant. Even as a youth, my imagination was very literal. Then, Dr. Bess Hippocrates, when I started reading on my own. Then, Dr. Helen von Humboldt. I had a hard time committing to a make-believe persona, but Joanna was always Miss Glass, the fearless adventurer who often had to be saved, usually from the grievous injuries her bravery and fondness for risk brought upon her, by my level-headed doctor, who would then advise her to act with more prudence before they set off on their next wild adventure. "She'll remember me," I say to Sim. I'm just not sure Joanna will remember any of those childhood games. They're all obscured now by the long, lean shadow of our sour parting. The 3 years that stretch between then and now feel impossibly vast as we turn up the drive of the house. House Hoffman is painted the bright pink of grapefruit pulp, with gold and white trimming and shingles in the same shades capping it like a crown. It looks made of cake and frosting, an extravagant birthday treat that will leave your teeth aching from the sweetness. The drive is split by a fountain, frozen in repose, the hedges rimming it bare as the trees, but still imposing. It has been so very easy to divorce Joanna from this scheme. I had enough to think about aside from her. Alexander Platt, whatever the crown and cleaver upon Sim's arm means, and why she is so desperate for a spot in this house. But as we climb the drive, knapsacks thumping in time against our backs, I think for the first time of the next few weeks in their entirety, without skipping over the part where I must see Joanna again. I don't know what I'll say. I don't know if I want to apologize, or if I want her to. We are a bedraggled pair that pulls the bell cord, far rougher around the edges than is likely to create a believable image of a rich English girl come from boarding school to her best friend's wedding, attended by her maid.
"What's your surname again?"
Sim asks, both of us staring at the door. "Montague. Why?"
"I'm going to introduce you."
"No, let me do the talking."
"It makes more sense."
She breaks off as the door opens. A butler greets us, a tall, aging gent with more hair in his ears than atop his head. He looks wrung out and put out and like he'll fall for nothing. I have learned that men respond best to non-threatening women whose presence and space in the world does not somehow imperil their manhood. And so, as much as it pains me, I put on a smile so big it hurts my face and try to think like Monty, which is infuriating. "Be charming," I tell myself. "Do not scowl." But when his eyes meet mine, I'm gut-stuck with the sudden fear that we shall be foiled before we're even permitted to cross the threshold. I shall never meet Alexander Platt. I shall never escape Edinburgh and Callum and a future filled with bread and buns and babies. I shall always have to push myself aside to make room for others in my own life. But then, I will also never have to face Joanna Hoffman. The scales tip. "Good day," I say, right at the same time Sim does. We glare at each other. The butler looks ready to shut the door in our faces due to a lack of communication and decorum, so I say quickly, "My name is Miss Felicity Montague. I'm here for the wedding."
"I was not told to expect any more guests," he says.
I swallow. My mouth has gone very dry, as if all the moisture in the body was slowly sucked from me by the long walk. Reaffix my best, sweet, innocent slip of a thing face, which uses muscles that have grown stiff from lack of practice, and, Lord help me, the actual phrase, "What would Monty do?" manifests like an unwanted house guest in my mind. Did my letter not arrive? Joanna, Miss Hoffman and I are good friends from childhood. I grew up in Cheshire with her. I've been at school not far from here, and I heard she was to be married, and I simply had to come. She's the best friend I've ever had, and I couldn't miss her nuptials. Perhaps it was not the wisest play to show all my cards immediately upon arrival. I have just offered up the entirety of the story I am reliant upon to get us a place in this house in a single mouthful, and I'm not certain he's swallowing it. So I tack on, for good pathetic measure, "Did the letter truly not arrive?" Rather than answering, the butler simply repeats, "Miss Hoffman did not inform me to expect any more guests." Oh, my heart hiccups, but this fight is far from over. I select the next weapon from my feminine arsenal, the damsel in distress. "Well, I suppose I could just go back to the town and wait to see if you receive the letter." I heave the weariest sigh I can muster. Zounds, it was such a trip, and my girl has been limping on a twisted ankle since Stuttgart. I give Sim a nudge, and she obediently begins rubbing her ankle. It's a far less convincing performance than mine, but I turn back to the butler and attempt to bat my eyelashes. It must come off rather more as trying to rid my eyes of something irritating, for he asks, "Do you require a handkerchief, madam?" I was hoping to elicit pity, but this ghoul of a man seems to have not a single drop of charity to be wrung from him. Simpering seemed the best method. Simpering and simple, my two least favourite things for a woman to be, but the two things men like most, to approach a gentleman such as this fuzzy-eared sod. But he's so obviously unmoved, and also I think I shall faint from the effort if I'm forced to remain this repressed. So instead, I change course dramatically, and rather than playing my brother, I play myself. I stand straight, with my hands upon my hips, drop my dimpled smile, and adopt the tone I found most effective in ordering Monty about on our tour when he was dragging his feet and moaning about his poor toes as though we had some other choice of how to travel and were simply holding out on him. "Sir," I say to the butler, "we have come a great distance, as is obvious if you care to make any observation of our current state. I am exhausted, as is my lady, and here I am telling you, my dearest friend in the world," I am unintentionally escalating the significance of my relationship to Joanna with each retelling, but I press on, "is to be wed, and you will not even allow me to cross through your door. I demand first an audience with Miss Hoffman so that she can make judgments for herself to our acquaintance, and, should she decline to allow us to attend her wedding, you can at least have the decency to put us up for the night." Which cracks him for the first time. The guardian of the grapefruit house, rendered stunned and mute by how firmly and confidently I spoke to him. Sim, in contrast, looks rather impressed. Then the butler says, "I believe Miss Hoffman is dressing for dinner." "Zounds, really?" I say, before I can help it. "It's hardly mid-afternoon." The butler either chooses not to comment, or his ears are so encased in hair he does not hear my aside, for he continues, "I will see if she is available for an audience." "Thank you." I take two fistfuls of my skirts and push past him into the entryway, thinking it will make me seem as impressive and authoritative as my tone led him to believe I am, only to then have to stop dead and wait for him to lead, as I've no idea where I'm going. He doesn't offer to take my winter things. He doesn't seem to think I'll be staying long. Sim appears at my side and makes a big show of leaning over to unfasten my cloak, while really using it as an excuse to hiss into my ear.
No snapping her head off, Crocodile. You're friends, remember?
I'm not going to be cross with Joanna unless she's as much of a stooge to me as her butler was, I reply, then add, against my better judgment, but compelled to defend myself. And I'm not a crocodile. If I'm to be an animal, I would like to be a fox.
Well then, Foxy.
She whips the cloak off from around my shoulders, then smooths the collar of my dress, her hands lingering on my breastbone.
You've only got one chance at this, so make it count.
I'd make it count even if I had 20, thank you.
And you wonder why I worry about you charming your way into a wedding party, she murmurs,
and I truly cannot tell if she's about to smile or grimace.
The butler returns before I can reply, leaving Sim aggravatingly with the last word. I'm escorted into a sitting room off the entryway and seated upon a sofa. I try to neither settle too far back upon it nor sit too close to the edge, wishing for perhaps the first time that I actually had sat a lesson at the finishing school my father was determined to send me to, just to better create the illusion of ladyship. There are so many invisible layers to decorum that you don't think of until you're staring them down across a fancy parlour. I have never done any sofa sitting in my life that felt as though it mattered as much as this. There are footsteps in the hallway, and I stand, expecting the butler. But instead, in prances a dog the size of the sofa, gangly limbs and swinging jowls, and a coiffure of a tail that bobs above him like a feather in a jaunty cap. His coat is shiny with care, blemished only by the bubbles of saliva gathering in the folds of his lips. The dog bounds over to me and presses his head into my knees with such enthusiasm that I promptly sit down again on the sofa, which only delights him further, for it makes my face more accessible to his mouth. He leaps at me with what I guess from his tail and perked ears is joy at the prospect of a new friend, but he's overly zealous and comes at me with his enormous jaws gaping wide. I shriek without meaning to, though in my defence, what rational being wouldn't when approached by an open mouth in which your whole head could fit?
Maximus, down! Off! Get off her! Max, come here!
The dog is wrangled off me, our only connection the long strings of drool that run between his mouth and my shoulders.
Sorry, sorry, he's harmless. He's such a big love. He just wants to be chums with everyone and doesn't seem to realise he's bigger than they are.
I look up, and she looks up at the same time from where she's crouched on the floor with her arms around the neck of her dog. And there is Joanna Hoffman. It is not so long that we have been apart, but in this moment, our 2 years of separation feel more enormous than all the years we spent together. The difference between 14 and 16 feels like centuries, time the greatest distance that can stretch between two people. There is no chance I would not have recognised her, but somehow she's a different person from my memories. Her hair is the same brown, so dark it's almost black, eyes hooded and deep green, but it's like she's better settled into her own skin. She was a round child, with spotty cheeks adolescence wasn't kind to, but either time or expensive milk baths or a very well-laced set of silk stays has made her into a Renaissance muse, shapely and curved in a way my stocky geometric frame never will be. Even under the wide panniers at her waist, her hips swing. Her face is powdered white with just the faintest hint of rouge, as though she has been caught in a maidenly blush. Or maybe she's blushing in earnest to see me. I might be as well. For even as I look at her, in a bright, dreamy blue day dress with an embroidered bodice and a tiered skirt and 2 strings of pearls around her neck, all I can think of is the girl who used to walk barefoot with me in streams, never caring if her hems muddied, who grabbed a snake by the throat and carried him off the road to save him from being bisected by a carriage, who went with me to the butcher's shop to watch them empty entrails from the pigs and cows and helped me understand how everything inside of a thing wound together. Joanna Hoffman had never minded dirt under her fingernails, until suddenly she had. And that was when she had left me behind in favour of company she had decided was more appropriate for her new self. A part of me, I realise as she stands, one hand resting upon her massive dog's head, the only sound is him panting like a windstorm, had hoped that I would find her with muddy knees from running through the grounds, shoes worn through at the toes, her hair studded with twigs, and her pockets full of the baby birds she'd rescued when they fell from their nests. But instead, with her hair curled and her breasts pushed up, she's the cream puff that I cut all ties with. "Felicity," she says, and zoons. I had forgotten how high her voice is. It was a sing-song soprano even when we were children, but in that excessive dress it feels put on, like she's playing up the girlish simper. I scrunch up my forehead without meaning to, then remember I am trying to win her over. I am trying to remind her we were friends. Dear Lord, were we? "Joanna," I say in return, and I make myself smile, because she is marrying Dr. Platt, and I want to work for Dr. Platt, and there's no chance I'll ruin that by making a bad impression on the person who likely has the most influence over him. Or rather, I'll try not to ruin things any more than I did 2 years ago. "It's so good to see you." She does not return the smile. "What are you doing here?" "I'm... what am I? That's actually rather a good story. So, since we last saw each other, or rather, since you left, your father died, which is... I'm... sorry, is your dog all right?" I'm trying not to stare at the saliva foaming upon his lips, but it's impossible not to. He's breathing rather heavily. Joanna doesn't look away from me, nor does she uncuff the beastie.
"He's fine. That's just how he sounds."
"Consumptive.
Alpine mastiffs have a lot of excess skin to breathe through."
She reaches down and swipes a handful of slobber ribbons from under his mouth, and for a moment, there she is, my best friend who loved animals and feared no mess. But then she looks around for something to wipe her hand upon, and, finding nothing, waves it about with her fingers splayed until the butler appears with a handkerchief. Then we're alone again, staring, each a ghost to the other. "May I sit down?" I ask. She gives me an indifferent shrug, so I resume my perch upon the couch. Max lunges forward, my face once again at the perfect angle for examining it with his tongue, but Joanna catches him by a roll of back fat. So many folds and so much hair I lose sight of her hand for a moment and pulls him over with her to a chair, where she wraps her arms around his neck and rests her chin upon his head, pinning him in place.
"What are you doing here?" she asks again, her eyes fixed on me.
"I'm here for your wedding."
"I thought you might write."
"I tried, but your gentleman said it didn't arrive, so I expect a week after you're wed you'll get my missive about coming to your wedding."
"I don't mean about the wedding," she interrupts. "I thought some day you might write to me, as a friend."
A vein splits open inside me, guilt and hurt spilling out in equal measure. "I did," I say. "About the wedding." She looks away, the tip of her tongue jutting out between her teeth.
"How did you hear I was getting married?"
"Oh, you know, things travel around, gossip and..." I stop. Joanna licks her lips. Max also licks his, tongue wrapping all the way around his nose. "I've been at school," I say, which is the lie I decided upon, for it most closely aligns with what I am currently supposed to be doing. It's unlikely that Joanna, so far from home, would have heard about my disappearance during my tour, and even unlikelier that, had she known, she would have run to my father and put an X upon the map for him to mark my location. Most unlikely of all that he would care. But lies are easiest to believe, and to remember, when they bump against the truth, and school is a good excuse for my limited wardrobe.
School?
She smiles, and it is the first time she's looked like herself.
You've finally got to go.
I mean, it's not quite... Yes! It's not worth digging into the injustice of the fact that the school I should currently be attending is one for manners and not medicine.
Yes, I got to go to school. And you have a giant dog. And you're getting married. That's a thing that is happening, and that's wonderful for you. It's so wonderful, just wonderful, that we both got
what we wanted, she finishes for me.
Did we?
I want to shout at her. Because once we wanted to go on an expedition together and collect previously unknown medicinal plants and species and bring them back to London to be cultivated and studied. I thought I had long ago cut Joanna from me like a cancer, but you cannot simply hack yourself apart in hopes of healing faster. Best not to have friends at all, I remind myself. Best to explore the jungles alone. I am unravelling, and Joanna is still staring at me like I'm a spider crawled up from the floorboards and inching toward her. What I would like to say is that I remember when she aspired to more than a rich husband and domestic bliss. I remember how she audaciously declared that she would be the first woman to present before the Royal Society, that she would go on expeditions, bring new species home to England to study.
"I can't wait to meet your fiancé," I blurt. "Dr..."
I fake a fumble for the name, like he hasn't been a saint to me for years, and like he's definitely not the reason I'm here.
"Platt,"
Joanna finishes for me.
"Alexander Platt. You don't have to pretend."
"Pretend what?"
"That you don't know who he is. You love his books."
"You remember that?"
"You wanted me to name that kitten I found under our house, Alexander Platt, even though she was a girl."
"Alexander could be a gender-neutral name." I scratch the back of my neck. The collar of my dress feels very tight. I was hoping she had forgotten my obsession with Alexander Platt so that she could have no leverage against me. Knowing how much I want to meet him, how much I admire him, means she knows where to wound me. She knows how savage it would be to turn me out now.
"How did you two meet?"
"He and my uncle are in business together."
She mashes her thumbs behind the dog's ears, and he closes his eyes in bliss.
"Dr. Platt is organizing a scientific expedition, and my uncle is providing the ship for the voyage. He came over for dinner one evening to discuss finances, and I was just smitten."
She throws her hands up in the air like she's tossing confetti.
"I wonder if it's appropriate to ask how soon they're leaving and what research he's working on. All I want to ask about is Platt."
But then Joanna pulls in her cheeks too hard and bites down upon them so that she looks like a fish. It's a nervous habit from childhood, one she used to do so often in the presence of her father that the insides of her cheeks would bleed. And for a moment, I'm 10 years old again, and I know her as well as I know the sound of my own voice. As much as I had told myself over and over that I wasn't here for Joanna, she didn't matter. I'm here only for Platt, and don't care what she thinks of me any more. I suddenly find myself blurting, "I should have written." Her face relaxes, lips falling back into their painted part. I swallow.
"I mean, I shouldn't have had to write, because I should have apologized after your father died, before you left. I should have apologized, and we should have been writing each other all this time because we were friends, and I'm sorry I didn't do any of that."
"I wish you had."
The dog rests his head upon her lap, and she strokes his nose absently, her eyes still on me.
"I'm sorry I'm here," I say.
I can leave if you want. From out in the hallway, I swear I hear Sim choke.
No, Joanna says quickly. No, don't leave. I want you to stay.
I take perhaps my first deep breath since we left England, so loud it rivals Max's consumptive snuffles.
Really? You sound surprised.
I am. I mean, if I were you, I wouldn't want anything to do with me. She stands up, her hand disappearing again into the folds of her dog. Her skirt fans around her, a cascade of brocade silk and too many petticoats, the edges fringed with lace and bows. When she looks at me, I am disarmed.
Well then, she says,
and I don't know how I shall survive these next few days without drowning in her.
Lucky you're not me.
8.
At dinner, I expect I shall get my first glimpse of Alexander Platt. The dining room is crowded, and I am relegated to a place of dishonour, as far from the head of the table, where Joanna's uncle Herr Hoffmann sits, as is possible. I practically need a telescope to see him, and Joanna sitting beside him, with another empty chair beside her. Maddeningly empty, and no doubt reserved for her intended. It is still empty when the first course is served. It is still empty when the man beside me, who has to keep putting down his knife to pick up his ear trumpet, asks me,
"How do you know Miss Hoffmann?"
"We were friends as children," I say, jamming a frustrated knife at my mutton.
"Excuse me?"
"We grew up together," I say louder. He cups a hand to the end of his ear trumpet.
"What?"
"Friends."
"What?"
I nearly fling my knife down. "We were accomplices in a massive diamond heist in which we stole jewels off the neck of the Queen of Prussia, and now I'm here to claim what is owed me by any means necessary."
"Excuse me?"
The woman next to me leans forward in alarm, but the man just smiles.
How nice!"
To top the fact that Alexander Platt is not even here, the dress Sim purchased in town was made with a waistline that can only be described as aspirational. Sim had to fish me out of the silk and tighten my stays 3 times before I achieved the inconceivably small diameter deemed appropriate for a lady to make an impression at a social occasion. My bulbous shoulders feel likely to burst free at any moment. It's hard to focus on the meal when I'm thinking about Dr. Platt, and when I can't properly breathe, and also every time Joanna laughs, my heartbeat stammers. How is it, I wonder, that the brain and the heart can be so at odds and yet have such a profound effect upon the functions of the other? Dr. Platt has still not arrived by the end of dinner. The men go to the formal sitting room while the ladies make their way upstairs. I, for longer than is natural, stand in the hallway, weighing my options, but likely looking as though I'm a shape-shifting fairy tale creature able to choose which sex I would rather be for the evening. If Dr. Platt is to show up, he will certainly not be up in Joanna's rooms with the ladies, and I am not here to waste time talking about ribbon and music and whatever other insubstantial nonsense gets passed around in rooms full of women. I start toward the parlour, hoping that if I walk with enough confidence, I'll not be stopped. But the hairy-eared butler has me by the collar before I've crossed the threshold.
"The ladies are upstairs, Miss Montague."
"Oh." I smile, but do not attempt the eyelash bat again. "I've just got one quick thing to say to Herr Hoffmann, and then I'll follow." He is unmoved.
"I can convey the message to him."
"Oh, thank you. But actually, I lost an earring here earlier, and I wanted to look for it."
"I'll search for you."
I pretend to see someone in the room over his shoulder and wave. "I'll be right in," I call to this imaginary person. The butler doesn't move. I consider faking a fainting spell just for an excuse to call for a doctor and hope it's Platt. But that hardly seems an appropriate situation to then funnel into an intellectual discussion. Please, I say to the butler, and I hate how pleading my voice sounds. I do not like pleading. Reliance upon the whims of others makes me far too vulnerable to feel comfortable.
Excuse me,
someone says behind me, and the butler pulls me out of the way so the man can pass into the room. I glance sideways and recognize him at once from the etching of his likeness on the title page of Treatise on Human Blood and Its Movement Through the Body. Alexander Platt, I blurt. He stops, turns back to me.
Can I help you?
It's not a courteous question. It's brusque and annoyed. He looks exactly like himself, but more rumpled than I expected. He's unshaven, dark stubble in sharp contrast to his blonde wig with its ratty queue. His housecoat is not the sort of thing you'd wear to a party before your wedding in which you're trying to make a good impression in the home of your bride. He has an intense gaze, small dark eyes made smaller by a fringe of thick brows, and when he frowns at me, I forget every word I know. All I manage to stammer is, "You're Alexander Platt." He flips the lid of the snuff box in his hand, glancing over his shoulder at the room full of gentlemen waiting for him.
Do we know each other?
I'm Joanna Hoffman. I mean, I'm a friend of Joanna's. I'm for the wedding. Here for the wedding. Am I having a stroke? Not only are all the words I wish to say putting themselves in a random order in my brain, but I'm almost certain my voice is far too loud and my movements far too exaggerated. I've gone completely blank. All my planned brilliance with which I was going to win him over washed away at the sight of Alexander Platt in the flesh. He's looking at me, and all I can think to say is, "Hello!" And it comes out much higher than my voice usually is. Perhaps this is how people feel when they talk to someone they fancy, all fluttery and silly and everything tuned to the highest key. I certainly heard Monty's voice pitch when Percy walked into a room. I remember suddenly I have Dr. Cheselden's card in my pocket, stashed there for exactly this meeting, and I start to paw at my excessively large skirt for it.
Dr. Platt, you join us at last.
Joanna's uncle calls from the room, and Platt raises a hand. Before I've even had a chance to find my damn pocket, he gives me a nod and says,
"Have a good night."
Wait, no! I try to chase after him, but the butler catches me again. My arm whips out as he pulls me back, knocking a portrait off the wall. The glass cracks when it strikes the tile. Dr. Platt glances over his shoulder, and I'm not sure if I imagine it or if he actually winces. The butler stares at the broken frame, then at me. "I'll show myself to Miss Hoffman's rooms," I say, and slink away. There is a unique sort of agony to entering a party alone. It is the shuffle in, the survey, trying to spot allies and cracks in the fortress of guests where you might slide into a conversation with such ease that they will think you've been there all the while. It is the keen pinch of hanging in the doorway and knowing that people have seen you come in, but no one is pulling you over to their conversation or waving in greeting. Wondering if you can sidle up to the fringes of a conversation and laugh at just the right moment, and they'll part. It is an even more pernicious pain when it comes upon the heels of the social equivalent of vomiting partially digested entrails upon my idol. Joanna's apartments are swarming with women from dinner, all with waists tinier and hair taller than mine. The aroma of scent bags and a garden of fragrances crowd the air. I haven't any powder on. I never wore it at my parents' house unless a maid managed to catch me off guard and blow a puff in my face, and my skin feels garishly ruddy and freckled in the presence of these girls dusted pale as icing sugar with tiny pox patches spotting their cheeks. Their maids trail them, rearranging trains when they sit upon the silk couches, fetching them flutes of champagne, using a single finger wetted by a tongue to fix a smear of rouge. There are card tables where whist and faro are being dealt. Another table is laid with bonbons, silky pink entremets topped with chocolate flakes sculpted like sparrows, gingerbread, and salted toffees wrapped with spun sugar as fragile and translucent as the wings of a dragonfly, along with bottles of champagne and a pot of spiced wine. Joanna is both literally and figuratively in the centre of it all, talking to a small crowd of girls while others wait their turn to kiss her cheeks and offer her their congratulations. She drinks champagne and talks with her hands and speaks in arias. She wiggles her shoulders, points her tiny, perfect feet, sucks in her cheeks to make her face look thinner. It aggravates me, in the same way it did back in Cheshire, but not because she's putting on a party persona, it's because she's so bloody good at it. From his spot at the buffet table, Max galumps over to me, an enormous pink silk bow around his neck. He smashes his forehead into my knees until I consent to massage his ears. Then he walks over to the dessert table again and sits with an expectant look, as though greeting me has made him worthy of a treat. I almost bolt. I want nothing more than to run back to my room and hide in a book, the same way I have always done in the face of these gatherings. But I'm trying to make an impression. I'm trying to pretend I am an indoor cat. I am trying to get Dr. Platt, and since my impression was so disastrous, the best way to do that will be through Joanna. "You are Felicity Montague," I remind myself. "You had your brother tackled into the London harbour and found Alexander Platt and are absolutely going to make up for that embarrassing incident earlier." Since the knot of women around Joanna is too intimidating to breach just yet, I take a tentative seat on a couch near the door, next to a woman who looks a little older than me. She catches my eye and gives me an obligatory smile over her champagne. I look away, am then mortified that was my reaction to being smiled at, and say, too loudly and without introduction, "I like your eyebrows!" I had spun a mental wheel and picked the least flattering feature to compliment a woman on. She looks surprised, as any person would at such a bizarre statement so loudly uttered. "Oh, thank you." She purses her lips, looks me up and down, then says, "Yours are also nice." "Yes." I stare at her for a moment longer, then I nod too vigorously. Then I ask, "How many bones in the human body can you name?" And dear Lord, what is happening to me? Why don't I know how to talk politely to other women? "Excuse me." I flee to the food, take up a glass of spiced wine, and think about a pastry as well, but decide I'd rather not risk spilling something down my front. There's a knot of women standing by the dressing room staring at me, and when I look back at them, they all duck and giggle, and I hate these girls. I hate them so much. I hate the way they giggle and look at me when I don't, and then it feels as though I'm being laughed at, and they're all in on it, and I'm not. It's my whole childhood being sneered at by watery girls for a joke. I didn't understand because I was reading books they could never understand. For a woman who boasts that she doesn't give a fig what anyone thinks of her, I certainly have a lot of party-related anxiety. Max seats himself upon my hem and looks up at me with his drooping eyes. The white spots above them make him look grotesquely expressive. "You have very nice eyebrows," I tell him, and give him a flat-handed pat to the head. He licks his lips, then goes on staring at my glass. Of course, the moment I get around other females my own age, I end up socializing with the dog.
"Well, don't you look aggressively miserable?"
someone says, and I turn. Joanna has extricated herself from her harem and come to stand beside me at the window. Max leans into her, his tail thumping happily between her backside and mine. It's a nice party, I say.
It is,
she replies, reaching down to massage Max's head. So why do you look like you're having your teeth pulled? What's the matter? I'm just... I consider lying. Saying I'm tired from my trip or ate something at supper that didn't agree with me. But a strange sort of instinct sets in when I meet her eyes. I used to tell Joanna everything. I'm so bad at this, I say.
At what?
This. I flap a general hand at the room full of women. Talking to girls and socializing and being normal.
You're normal?
I'm not. I feel like a wild animal in a menagerie, ragged and feral and unsocialized among all these women who don't tip over in heels or itch the powder off their face. As Sim proclaimed, a crocodile in a cage full of swans. I'm prickly and off-putting and odd and not always nice. Joanna takes some macaron from the buffet table and licks a dab of filling off her fingers.
No one's good at these things.
Everyone here is.
Everyone is faking it, she says. Most of these women don't know each other. They likely all feel just as misplaced and awkward as you.
You don't?
Well, it's my party.
But you're good at this, I say. You always have been. That's why people liked you back home and not me. Girls like me are meant to have books instead of friends.
Why can't you have both?
She takes a bite of her macaron, then tosses the rest to Max, who, in spite of how large an area his mouth covers, misses it entirely and has to chase it down under the table.
I think you need to give people a chance, including yourself.
She reaches out and puts a light hand on my elbow. Promise me you'll stay tonight and at least try to have a good time. I run my tongue along my teeth, then let out a sigh through my nose. I feel like I owe this to her, and also am completely maddened by that. I do not enjoy being beholden, so perhaps it's best if I pay off this debt as quickly as possible.
Must I?
And you have to talk to at least three people. All right, you're one. Three people you don't already know. Max does not count, she says, reading my mind. If I talk to three people, may I then leave? Her head cants to the side, and I can't tell if her smile actually saddens or if it's simply the angle.
Are you really that desperate to be away from me?
I look away to our reflections in the glass, made black by the darkness. It feels like looking through a window into a shadow version of ourselves, the girls who could have existed if Joanna and I hadn't fought. Maybe if things had gone differently, I'd be here as an attendant at her wedding, invited and wanted, and not kicking my feet in the corner. Or maybe we'd neither of us be here. Maybe we'd have run away together long ago, gone to find her mother who had left her and her father when she was a child, or found a world of our own away from all of this.
Miss Joanna,
someone calls, and we turn as a very blonde, very pretty girl with a very narrow waist comes over to us. She wraps an arm around Joanna's stomach from behind and cuddles into her neck. Max leans into them both. The girl looks up at me with enormous blue eyes.
Who's this?
This is my friend, Felicity Montague, Joanna replies. We grew up together.
Oh, in England. You've come so far.
The girl holds out her hand to me over Joanna's shoulder.
Christina Gottschalk.
With her hand in front of her stomach and out of Christina's sight, Joanna holds up a single finger and mouths to me,
That's one.
I almost laugh. Christina gives me a smile I'm not sure I believe is genuine, then turns her face back up to Joanna.
I have to give you a scolding.
Me?
Joanna presses a hand to her breasts.
Why?
Your Dr. Platt about scared my poor girl to death last night.
A conversation I was about to be forced to tolerate has just become sincerely interesting to me, as it involves Platt. Perhaps I'll actually be quite good at socializing after all. What happened? I ask.
My maid went last night to fetch me milk, and he gave her a terrible scare, Christina says. He was up in the library at God knows what hour, pacing and jabbering to himself. Said he started to shout at her for creeping about.
Joanna runs a finger around the rim of her glass. She does not look at all thrilled by this conversation topic.
Yes, he's a bit manic when he's dosed.
That's the peril of marrying a genius, isn't it? Christina says. They're either depressingly gloomy or terribly insane, sometimes both at once.
Is he often in the library? I ask. Joanna's eyes narrow at me. She knows exactly the game I'm playing, but won't give it a name in front of her friend.
He works late and sleeps late. It's his way. We don't see him until supper most days.
And not even supper today, Christina says, which is perhaps meant to make Joanna feel better, but instead has her sucking in her cheeks again.
If Dr. Platt is hanging about the Hoffman Library alone each night, that will give me the perfect opportunity to chat with him, without butlers or gentlemen or my inability to have articulate conversations with no warning getting in the way. But Joanna has me trapped, both in this conversation, which is turning to a discussion of melon water in comparison to cucumber for a smooth complexion, and by my promise to speak to 3 new people. There has to be a way to create a good reason to slip away and position myself in wait for Dr. Platt without wasting time making good on that promise. So the next time Max knocks into me, I use it as an excuse to empty my wine glass down my front. I only intend for it to be a dribble, a small splatter that would give me enough reason to say I just have to run back to my room and change, but in truth, sneak down to the library and wait for Platt. It is, however, a more effective display than planned. Firstly, I had not drunk as much as I thought, so rather than a few small drops discreetly spilled, I pour almost a full glass of wine straight down the front of my dress. It's such a direct shot that I can feel it soak all the way into my knickers. Joanna and Christina both shriek in surprise. I open my mouth to make an excuse and pretend like I have just spilled a normal amount of drink rather than poured a glass down my front. But before I can get a word out, Max leaps at me, trying to lick it off. His weight sends me flying backwards. I throw out a hand to steady myself, miss my mark at the edge of the buffet table and smash it straight into the creamy centre of a plate of entremets. Max, now with even more opportunity for carnage, leaps forward, paws upon the table and plunges his nose in after me, splattering me with thick globs of cream. It effectively grinds the party to a halt. It is also a bit more embarrassing than I had expected it to be, particularly considering that I was the architect of the disaster. Well, the first part, at least. Joanna apologizes over and over as she wrestles Max off the food, long strings of saliva trailing from his lips to the pastry as he tries desperately to gulp a few more bites before Joanna reaches down his throat and pulls out an entire metal spoon he inhaled in his haste. She's covered up to her elbow in slime. I've got wine down the front of my dress and pastry cream splattered across my side and fur clinging to both. Christina has a small splatter of wine on her skirt and seems intent on pretending she is as victimized as I am. I'm so sorry, I say, and Joanna looks up from Max. I can see in her eyes she knows exactly how intentional this was, whether or not I meant for it to ruin the party. Just go, she says, her voice so low no one hears but me. It's what you wanted, isn't it? And yes, it's exactly what I wanted. But as I make my head-down, tail-tucked exit, I rather wish it hadn't been. Sim isn't in our shared room, which is unfortunate, as it leaves me with the task of getting myself out of this dress alone. The rules of fashion dictate that anything a man wears, a lady must wear more of. It must be more uncomfortable for her, and it must require at least two people to get her into and out of it, so that she is rendered incapable of an independent existence. I can't even reach the damn buttons running up the back, let alone unfasten them. I keep turning in circles like a dog chasing its tail, trying each time to stretch my arm just a bit farther while holding on to the deranged hope that perhaps, if I catch the buttons by surprise, they won't dart away from me. And every second I waste spinning is a second I might be missing Dr. Platt in the library. At last, I give up, decide to wear the wine with confidence, even though it's starting to turn from sticky to crunchy, and head below stairs. The gentleman's party in the parlour is still loudly in progress, so I make a quiet slip into the library, in case the hairy-eared butler is lurking, ready to send me back to Joanna's rooms. The room is warm and smells like dust, and just the presence of so many books makes it easier to breathe. It's remarkable how being around books, even those you've never read, can have a calming effect, like walking into a crowded party and finding it full of people you know.
What are you doing here?
I spin around with a squeak. Sim is standing behind me, lurking in between two of the stacks and either unaware or unperturbed by the scare she just gave me.
Soons, don't do that!
Do what? Address you?
Sneak up on me like that, or sneak around full stop. People will think you're up to something.
What people? You people?
Yes, me people. What are you doing here? You're supposed to be a maid, remember? I'm fairly certain this room is off-limits.
I'm cleaning it.
She swabs a sleeve along the nearest shelf without looking at it.
There, all clean.
Have you found your birthright yet? I ask. It's too dark to really tell, but I swear I hear her eyes narrow.
Have you talked to your Dr. Platt yet?
Is that it? I point to the large leather book she's got tucked under her arm, and she immediately pushes it behind her skirt.
Is what it?
That book you're ineffectively hiding. You can't take it with you. No stealing, remember. That's our agreement. Is it what you're looking for? She doesn't say anything, so I hold out my hands. May I? Reluctantly, she surrenders. It's not a book, I realise, as I carry it over to one of the reading stands with a lit lantern upon it, but more a folio. The cover is monogrammed with the initials SG and a date almost 20 years previous. Inside are intricate botanical drawings, cross-sections of tulip bulbs and mulberry trees, the delicate veins of leaves mapped like tributaries, and a whole page dedicated to the many ways of looking at a mushroom. It's all done in the sort of minute detail that makes my hand shake just to think of attempting it. I look up at Sim, standing on the other side of the lectern, watching me turn the portfolio pages with her teeth working on her thumbnail. Did you come all the way here to look at a book about nature? I ask. She keeps her nail in her mouth, speaking through teeth gritted around it.
Why does it matter?
It doesn't, I say. That's just very much something I would do. She stops grinding her teeth. Then a slow smile spreads over her lips.
And here you thought we'd have nothing in common.
I turn another page and stare down at a sketch of a long snake moving through water, its nostrils bobbing above the surface. I can't imagine what it is about this work that drew her from a continent away just to see it. I thumb the edges, realizing that, more than anything, it's a relief. No matter Sim's protestations otherwise, and that she came to see me through Scipio, A small part of me had been chewing its fingernails with certainty that she was here to slit a throat or steal a diamond, and I would be complicit for the access I provided. "What's so special about this book?" I ask.
"It's not a book. It's a portfolio," she replies. "And it's the only copy."
Well, yes, I assumed that if it